you know, it's been my experience, and I've had a lot of interaction with a lot of people from the U.S., and there's this assumption that Canada is so wonderful for wildlife, and they're actually shocked when they find that's the opposite.
Of course, the American frontier has shrunk, and the last big frontier for lots of animals are Alaska and Canada, where you've got big guys are still up there in numbers, and grizzlies and wolves, and they're up there in numbers. And this frontier view of Canada that the states used to have of itself has been displaced, and Canada is seen as having all these animals, and paradoxically appreciating them as well, which is wrong.
There is, and I think you bring this up, I'm not sure what the term you use, but there is a narrative, this is what I call it, language manipulation, used by individuals, groups, and even media, that justifies wildlife as a resource or we need to eliminate it. There's the words like it, thing, vermin, beast, threat, harvest, and euthanize.
These sanitation words that's one way of doing it. Is simply
why does this need to stop? Still going on all the time.
The trouble is, in a practical sense, you haven't got a pronoun. You haven't got a pronoun that that refers to an animal without a gender description, and because gender description doesn't matter, there is no third person program pronoun, and we don't tend to not use first person pronouns. I tried to. The only way I could get out of it, use it, was change the original one to plural, and then I could say theirs or them, which is common with humans as well. But I noticed I tried to use her and it every time, her and him, all through the book. But because I was constrained by the language itself. But yes, it does tend to objectify the animal. But you'll see where you see it in everyday life. You see it where a bunch of guys will jump into a river and drag a deer out. And you'll see all sorts of heroic efforts to save a single animal. Yet, and Leopold said that himself. Yet you'll go out and shoot one out of the sky, and that appears to be different because in its heart it doesn't exist. And this kind of cognitive dissonance apply to animals, and it's a big issue. It's a big issue, and one that needs to be addressed. You can't just talk about loving an individual and going out and shooting one of a group because it's not the individual you saved. In other words, the individual is only important right there at that time because you can help that poor creature. But it, out in the woods, is just another guy who's subject to a hunter's rifle, and that to me. But see, that's where rationalizations get you, Troy. Excessive rationalizations breeds logically and naturally into cognitive dissonance.
One thing, and you meant when you were talking about hunters, my favorite statement that they make is hunters are true conservationists today.
It's a myth that's become a truth. And a lot of myths become truths. Religion is a big example when myths and stories become truths, cultural truths. And the hunter's conservation has become a myth. It's become a cultural truth. They're not conservationists at all because they don't understand the difference between prey and prey dynamics and prey switch and prey fleeing and the ratio of killing. It's rationalized by what I call as a fixed in time concept of ecological integrity. Now, there's no such thing as a fixed state of ecological integrity. Ecological integrity is always changing, and because we've habituated ourselves too much in urban ways and urban ways of thinking, that we buy into this ecological integrity as a fixed in time, and therefore in order to keep it as a fixed in time state, you need to take out the predators by hunting, and that's not right. If you let the natural processes take, the ecological integrity will maintain themselves because predators will do what they do. But I think it's all linked with we think ecological integrity is a constant, and ecological integrity is not a constant; it's a variable. And so, but when we look at it that way, then you've got all sorts of things open up, because what do we do? And I thought it's a result of what we've, of the corner we've backed ourselves into, allowed a myth like that to become a cultural truth, because we've backed ourselves into a corner and we can't counteract it. We can't contradict it well enough. And without saying, if we allowed ecological integrity process to unfold, we wouldn't be in the problem we are. But I say, well, we can't do this. We've got to have farms. We've got to have this. We've got to feed people. We've got to do this. And they've got a point, you know. And so part of it is the ease in which a myth has become a cultural truth, when in reality it is not. The what they're doing now is, what hunters are doing in their conservation is inducing more faster evolution. Animals within generations now are being smaller, and with smaller heads and smaller brains, and this has been caused by hunters, and they've induced this, and we don't know the end result of this. Way down the line, we might look what we've done. We don't know the long range implications of this widespread hunting as conservationists, and they're not.
Interesting things you say in this book. So I'm just going to, there's three of them I want to highlight. The first one is, the price of change is too high.
Yeah. That means that we're going to have to give up. It's like climate change and greenhouse gas. The price of change is too high because you're not willing to pay the money to and make the sacrifices in order to reduce your greenhouse gases. The price of change, if we change our belief system, we're going to give up a lot of what we take for granted, and we're not prepared to pay the price. We never will be, because human is human self-interest, price of change is too high. Yep.
And this was, I think, one of my favorites. Wildlife has been treated like a neutered specific species resource.
Just doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. It's just out there. It's an object. And you see, I blame the behaviorists for that. And I blame the conservationists of the first part of this century for I think now. I blame the behaviorists, because the behaviorists said that you can't make a statement of truth about anything unless you can see it. And because we can convey, our humans, we've got language, and we can convey our feelings to each other. We can do that. But animals have no language, and therefore they can't convey their feelings to us. Therefore, we don't know if they do have subjective experiences. That's okay, up to there. But conclusion is, because they can't convey their feelings to us, we must, and their subjective experiences and their rationality, because they can't convey it to us in speech, then it's okay to assume they haven't got any. And that's the bad one. That behaviorist philosophy is still ingrained. So conservationism and behavior, both hallmarks of the late 19th and early 20th century, hanging around with us today, still gone. And of course, Thomas Nagel says that's bullshit, you know, and you can't, and all the big ethologists say that's wrong. Animals, in fact, the opposite. Because you don't know, Thomas Nagel says, because you don't know it, doesn't mean you can conclude it's not there. And that seems self-evident. I think we got away from behaviorism because, you know, it's okay because I don't, and that, it's become a hallmark saying in our family now, because my two daughters and my four grandchildren, every one of them animal rights, every one of them vegetarian, and strident animal rights. But we've got our saying, we got it from Thomas Nagel, his marvellous article, What It's Like to Be a Bat. And he says, you might know everything to know about a bat. You might know everything there is to know about a bat, but you know what it's like to be a bat. And so we say, often you say, we're talking about a beaver, but we don't know what it's like to be that beaver. The squirrel out there, we got named Dorothy. Dorothy character out there. And she's a real character. And she indulges in what seems to be fairly rational behavior. And other times it's not rational. Why the hell is she doing that? And we say, because we don't know what it's like to be Dorothy. That's why.
And it's not rational to us.
Yeah, exactly. But this behaviorist thinking has got us thinking exactly the opposite direction. And maybe we're coming out of it now, Torrey. Maybe we are coming out of it now where we begin to see that animals do think independently. I think our close association with pets, but this is what gets me, our close association with pets and our close association with companion animals is leading us to believe how much like us they really are. But we will not apparently transpose that to wildlife. And wildlife are a darn sight smarter than said family pet. And
they have a lot harder life and a lot more challenges to deal with, right?
That's nothing wrong with loving your family pet, but the cougar and the wolf out there and the coyote way smarter in that. But my point was, while we seem to recognise the very qualities like us in our pets or our companion animals, we aren't prepared to offer the same sort of comparative conclusions about wild animals.
I do think it may be changing.
Ethologists who study animals in the wild are starting to convey that to us, and obvious evidence that what these doing porpoises keeping their friends afloat, language in magpies, and I saw we were driving along in the city, and we came across a dead baby magpie in the middle of the road, and his parents were all around it, and they were really upset. So my wife got out of the jeep, picked up the baby dead magpie, and took her to the side of the road, and they followed her, and then they just gathered, and they were shrieking and screaming. If that was, I don't know what was. That was anguish. That just wasn't reflex action. That's something, they're just making noises. That was anguish. But a lot of people wouldn't believe that. They were just fascinated by the fact that it was dead, it wouldn't move. They were puzzled by what its behavior. It's non-behavior, but that's what, the critics would say. But no, it was anguish. I saw it.
I just wanted to talk briefly about management policies, and you mentioned, say, for example, in BC, there is the adaptive management policy.
Again, they dress it up in nice clothing, a six-phase process. And if you look at the six-phase project, it says, well, if you keep on experimenting, we're going to find out an answer eventually. It has been pretty well come down to make a judgment call, do what you want. It's abused so much. In its pure sense, it has validity, particularly in, and I think it has very, very validity in dealing with inanimate objects, but I don't think it has a great deal of validity in dealing with living beings, particularly if said living being is going to be sacrificed as part of the experiment. Yeah. And adaptive, but it's the abuse of it. Like Canada, Parks Canada's got a policy that says we don't cull unless we tried everything else. Now they're culling moose in national parks and under the process of adaptive management. In other words, they're turning the first policy on its head and using the second one when adaptive management doesn't really say that. They're using adaptive management to kill them first. If they followed the true practice, the true precepts of adaptive management, that would reach the same conclusion as their original one was, don't kill unless there's no other choice. But now they've used adaptive management to say, okay, we kill first. And so it is abused, it's being abused on many fronts. To excuse to do what you want. Right. And I use the term rational empathy in my book, right at the conclusion. And, I don't have to love Heather loved the cougars. Heather loved wildlife. My wife, late wife. But I don't really love the cougar. I don't care if I don't see the cougar. But I do respect that cougar's right to live as I respect my own. And I am empathetic with that cougar in a rational sense. because I haven't got to love you, I haven't got to look after you, I haven't got to do anything for you, I haven't got to say even nice things about you, which I do. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is, I respect the cougar's right to live as much as I respect my own. And that's a rational, empathetic approach, and I think we should take that, you know. And the animal rights people have got something. Colin McGinn and some of the other guys, they're not the wackos you think they are. They're simply saying, hey, if a creature's got the capacity to have its own subjective experiences, to be itself, then it has the same right as we have.